History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative and ask a few questions, and then invest enough time to listen as those memories from long, long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories. So we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And when it comes to education, entertainment, and inspiration, I don't know if any of the veterans we've heard from on this program over the years has ever contributed more in those three areas than Jimmy Weldon, who passed away July 6th, just a couple months shy of his 100th birthday. His friends at American Legion Post 43 in Hollywood, where Jimmy was chaplain emeritus, planned to honor his legacy in September when he would have reached the century mark. But we're going to take the hour to honor him today. There are a lot of things we can say about this World War II veteran, but it could never be as memorable as what we'll hear come out of his mouth, whether speaking as himself or an unforgettable television cartoon duck.
There's a little duck named Yakky Doodle, and his best friend is Chopper, a great big bulldog. Fibber Fox or someone I'm talking about now in the Yogi Bear show. Someone's chasing him down the road and he calls to Chopper. Chopper tells him to run. He gets there, and when he does arrive, Chopper says, "Well, now you're safe, Yakky. Where is your mama?" And he always looked up sadly and said, "I don't have no mama. Would you be my mama? Only you'll remember it this way."
"Help! Chopper! Chopper, you're after me!"
"Run, little feller!"
"I'm running."
"Yakky, now that you're safe, tell me, where's your mama?"
"I don't have no mama. Would you be my mama?"
"I can't imagine I did that 53 years ago for Hanna-Barbera. Paul, how you doing? This is Jimmy Weldon."
I don't know if we've ever had an introduction quite like that on Hometown Heroes. That is something, and I'm sure you rang a lot of bells for a lot of people. How do you still do those voices at 92 years old?
"Well, just barely making it. You heard that. I always often tell, I say, Yakky, you don't sound like you used to. But, Paul, you're from Fresno. I spent most of my time on radio in Fresno, and up there I always had a show called Webster Webfoot. That was a little duck that I had on television. And so when Hanna-Barbera saw me on the air, they said, they called me and said, "Would you do the voice of a little duck in a new series we've got?" And I said, "Yeah." Had no idea what it would mean, but little Yakky Doodle has meant more for my career than anything I ever did. Of course, it is Webster's voice.
"I'm the star."
"Okay, don't do any more, Webster." But anyway, they do recognize Yakky Doodle more than little Webster. But I'll bet you remember Webster when you were a little boy, don't you? Are you? Well, no, you're not even old enough. You weren't even born then. Good gracious, I forgot. Yeah, this is back in 1952, 3 and 4. I was up there in 56, 7, 8, and then went back in 59, was there till 68 in Fresno on Channel 47.
Mm-hmm. You know what my first television job was? Channel 47.
Oh, golly.
And we're going to learn today the history behind Webster Webfoot and Yakky Doodle and where it all came from. And we're going to learn that it might never have happened if you didn't make it through World War II.
My passion today is talking to young people about America. I did a thing that was used on the USS Kennedy in the Persian Gulf during the Iraq War for 4,500 sailors. It's a flag, a tribute to our flag.
I've seen the video of you doing this, and it's powerful, and I'm glad you're bringing that up because I want all our folks to hear it. Do you want to do it now, or you want to save it for them?
Oh, well, if you don't care, I would do it.
Go for it.
All right, okay, I want you to imagine that you're looking at a flag, Stanley, and I'm out in the audience, and I'm going to walk up to the flag and hold it, and I'll even look at the audience until I say the end, and here it is. "I am the flag of the United States of America, conceived in the dreams of liberty and the hopes of freedom. I was designed by the hands of Betsy Ross and her sewing basket was my cradle. Though I was never an orphan, I was adopted by the Continental Congress in 1777 and proclaimed the national emblem of a nation newly born on this continent, fighting valiantly for survival and destined to bring to all mankind a new concept in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I rode with Ethan Allen, the Green Mountain Boys, at the Battle of Fort Bennington. I was flown above the decks of Old Ironsides and the mass of Yankee Clippers. I blazed the trail with Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett. I led the settlers coming west and crossed Death Valley in a covered wagon. Once I fell to the ground at Custer's last stand at the Little Bighorn. There were no living hands left to pick me up. But I galloped up the slopes of San Juan Hill with Colonel Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders in the United States Cavalry. I was carried through the halls of Montezuma onto the shores of Tripoli by the United States Marine Corps. I stayed with the boys till it was over there, on the battlefields of the Marne, Chateau Thierry, St. Mihiel, and the Argonne Forest. I saw many of the youth and manhood of our nation fall and lie still in death, that given their last full measure of blood. The war was over for them forever, but I kept my lonely vigil over their graves and stayed to watch the poppies growing into crosses row on row in Flanders Field. I was raised by six brave Marines and sailors during the hell of Iwo Jima in the final hours of World War II. Haven't changed much. 239 years. I still have my original 13 stripes, but as each state came in the Union, a new star was proudly added to the constellation of my blue field. Start with 13, now they're 50. I've draped the caskets of our nation's heroes and borne to their last resting place the bodies of presidents, generals, admirals, humble privates, and the unknown soldier. Wherever free men gather, wherever there's justice, equality, faith, hope, charity, truth, and brotherly love, there too am I. When you stand with your hand over your heart and recite the Pledge of Allegiance to me, don't merely mouth the words, but think of what they mean to you and mean what you say. And when you come to the phrase, One Nation Under God, remember, it matters not what your religious belief. It only matters that you hold your faith dear, that you practice it daily, and that you preserve it forever. History will never write my obituary, for I am the Stars and Stripes forever. I'm Old Glory. I'm your flag. I am you. I did that for the Burbank Middle School. The little boy in the back of the room said, that never happened when I told him I was with Patton's 3rd Army Combat Engineers that liberated Buchenwald Concentration Camp. When he said that, I just screamed out, don't say that! I was there! He backed up against the wall. Later, I talked to the largest Lions Club in Long Beach. When I mentioned this, a little man came out of the audience with a yarmulke on the back of his head, and he said, Jimmy, I'm Rabbi Cain. I was at Buchenwald Concentration Camp. We stood there hugging and crying in the middle of the room. Later he had a program called Survivors of the Holocaust and had me speak. He introduced me. He said, I'm here because Jimmy's here. That's one reason. I said, don't say that, Rabbi. But it did make me feel good, and I called my dear friend in Palm Springs, Dennis Daly. He was the top writer for United Press International over 20 years. This is the largest news organization in the world. It doesn't even exist anymore. It's gone. But I said, Dennis, what's happening to our country? He said, what do you mean? I told him what happened about that little boy, saying that never happened. He said, you've got to get a 501c3 nonprofit corporation and talk to schools. I got a what? He said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. A year and a half later, the IRS in Washington and a California legislator gave me a 501c3 nonprofit corporation entitled Center for Youth Patriotism. This is the motto statement that Dennis Daly wrote. To instill in California youth a sense of civic, nonpartisan pride and a better understanding of our common heritage through the use of visual, non-visual programs and personal appearances. And I thought, golly, now I can talk to schools and tell children about America. But the biggest honor, Paul, came when I talked to the military order of world wars. General Dan Pemberton walked up to me with a $100 bill in his hand. He put it out and he said, "Jimmy, put this in your little foundation with a promise to me." I said, "Sir?" He said, "Promise me you won't stop talking to young people about America." I said, "General," he said, "promise me." And I said, "I will, sir." Walked away with a tear in his eye. So now, when I'm speaking to these young people, I sit down, I look in the audience, I say, "Let me tell you something. You own this country. Those people in Washington work for us. We don't work for them. If you find something that's not in the Constitution, question it, because they're trying to rewrite history. Check the curriculum, what it says here. Our government is all powerful. You obey every order that's given." That's exactly the opposite of what I was taught as a young man in school. So when we close with our hands together in prayer, I've had administrators come up and say, "Jimmy, thank you for praying for our students. We can't do this." I think, "What do you mean? What has happened?" I pray that you'll study the people who love this country. And let's get those people back in Washington, going to the days when our founding fathers wrote those sacred documents, the Declaration of Independence and our Constitution. Hey, Paul, I'm sorry. I just got rambling. Can't stop. Forgive me.
I don't think anyone's complaining, Jimmy.
God bless you.
I wish they were all sitting here with me and could see the emotion in your face, but I know they hear it in your voice. They hear and they feel your passion for America and what it stands for. But I think it'd be interesting. I think our listeners would be interested to get your story and know where all of this came from, because clearly you're an amazing man with amazing energy and amazing talents. But take me back there. Take me back there to Oklahoma as a boy during the Great Depression. What was your life like back then?
Oh, Paul, thank you for saying that. I was 7 years old. I'm always talking about motivation. Key to success is motivation, having something to do. I wrote a book called Go Get 'Em, Tiger. And in this book, I always say, have a reason for getting out of bed, some reason for being. When I talk to AARP people my age, I say, "I greet you in the name of insurance actuary tables. We're all dead." They look at me and I say, "Wait a minute, we're all going to die. I was supposed to die 8 years ago. I want to tell you how to live." And they think, "Golly, that's different." But anyway, I tell these young people, plant a goal in your mind. Don't let anyone ever talk you out of it. The most important decision you ever make is planting a goal and deciding what you want to do. Secondly, to the commitment to your God. God's most important. But then second, be sure and know what you want to do. Have a reason, like I said. I was 7 years old and my two brothers took me to a movie, 10 Nights in a Bar Room. Now imagine a little seven-year-old boy going to a movie like that where the town drunk is a star and he's always at the saloon drinking, and his little daughter, 3 years old, walks through the swinging door every day and say, "Daddy, will you come home with me?" Like Foster Brooks, yeah. And this one day, she walked through the door and called to her dad to come to him, and the bartender's having a fight with him. He threw a bottle of beer at him, and he ducked and hit this little girl in the head, and I screamed, "Mama! Mama!" My two brothers had to take me home. I tell young people, remember, this computer of ours, our brain, is the most powerful piece of equipment that's ever designed. Everything you've ever seen, thought of, or done is in this computer. Not for instant recall. Because people like my age, we have senior moments. One guy said, the other said, "I can't remember your name." "She can't." "No, but I don't worry, because at our age, we lose millions of brain cells every day." "We do." "Yeah, your name is in one of those I just lost." But anyway, back again, when I was that little boy, I can see that now. I was sitting on the floor crying, and I said, "Mama, he killed that little girl." She said, "What little girl?" I said, "Mama, I saw him, he killed her." She said, "Babe, what are you talking about?" And I tried to explain about moving. She said, "No, that was play-like." I said, "Play-like? Mama, I saw the blood in her head." And she said, "No, that's probably ketchup." Well, as a seven-year-old boy, I said, "Okay, I can understand that." But then when she said, they probably gave her some milk and cookies after they did that scene, I remember sitting on the floor looking up at her, and I said, "Mama, if it's me, I'd want some vanilla wafers." She said, "They probably have those in Hollywood too, babe." Paul, never did I ever dream I would write a book one day called Go Get 'Em, Tiger. And the first chapter is the witnessed murder. "Mama, he killed that little girl." "What little girl?" "Mama, I saw him, he killed her." "Babe, what in the world are you talking about?" Almost 64 years have raced by since that little seven-year-old boy made those disturbing statements to his mother, who knelt down and tenderly wrapped her arms around him. Had no idea what she's going to say would crystallize my future. Yes, I was that little boy. Paul, God's blessed me in so many ways you can't imagine. I've spoken to more National Management Association chapters than any speaker in the United States. I used to go all over everywhere. All these CEOs say, put on paper what you tell our people. I said, I just barely got out of high school. I don't care. Write it down. So I did write it. Mm-hmm. But then, wait, that's my chapter in my first book. The only one I've got, first chapter.
Well, maybe you should write another one.
No. They've asked me that. I couldn't. But anyway, from that moment, I wanted to be an actor. And I knew one day I was coming to Hollywood, California, heard a little boy going, oh, boy, oh, boy, one day. And I said, hey, that sounded like Donald Duck. What do you think it's supposed to sound like? I don't know. I tried to imitate him. I couldn't make the sound. But finally, one morning, I went, that's it. Out the side of my mouth. Then I tried so hard to speak. Finally, 12 years old, I answered my teacher in school one day. She asked me something. I said, yes, ma'am, that's right. I had to stay in after school. On our 50th anniversary, our high school reunion, she walked up to me and she said, do you remember when I made you stay in after school for talking that duck talk to me? I said, yes, ma'am, Miss Bailey. She said, I was always afraid I might have inhibited you. I said, you really hurt me. I'd answer the phone.
Hello?
If it's one of my brother's friends, I'd say,
don't see you.
And they'd grab the phone. Mama, don't even answer the phone. He's crazy. He embarrasses. But anyway, that's where it all started when I was a little boy.
So you started the duck talk as
that's
a little
it.
Boy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you said you wanted to be an actor from that point on, huh?
Yes. I knew what I wanted to do. And that's why I said, plant a gold in your mind. Don't let anybody ever talk you out of it. Because all of us are different. And when I speak somewhere like at Pepperdine, I'll say, "How? What do you want to do?" One of them says, I want to be an attorney. What do you want to do? I want to be a doctor. I want to be a so-and-so. And I say, you see all the difference? We're all different. Then I say, you are the most important person in the world. You know more about yourself than all the people in the world combined. And you're the only person you're never going to leave. So it's up to you. You can do anything you want to if you believe you can. My business card, Paul, at the top says, Mark 9:23, if thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth. We had a carpenter that used to walk on the streets of Galilee. He said time and time again, as ye believe, so shall it be done unto you. It's so simple, we don't even realize it.
Mm-hmm.
All we have to do is just ask.
It's time for our first break, but if you've never heard Jimmy Weldon's story before, I don't think I really need to tell you to stick around. You can already tell what an incredibly captivating storyteller he was. The World War II veteran turned entertainer passed away July 6th at the age of 99. We're honoring his legacy today, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode honoring the life and legacy of perhaps the most entertaining World War II veteran we've ever heard from on Hometown Heroes, Jimmy Weldon, the voice of Yaki Doodle from the Yogi Bear Show, Webster Webfoot before that, and a lifelong patriot who loved to educate and inspire. Jimmy passed away July 6th in Paso Robles, California at the age of 99. He spent most of his adult life in the Golden State, but he grew up in Oklahoma during the Great Depression.
We didn't know what it was to not have something. We just didn't have it. Mm-hmm. I had all, my mom was, oh, how great. We had overalls, the little bib overalls that you put on, but they were always clean. Mom made sure that we were dressed clean. My dad had a service station, and he had to stay open 7 days a week, and it killed him because he wanted to go to church, but they made him stay open. And a lot of my little friends didn't even know him unless they saw him with that Texaco uniform on. He had one suit, and he wore that when we could go to church together. But answering your question, you know, like I say, all of us, we didn't know what it was not to to be poor. We just didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. But Dad used to laugh, said, my family has three meals a day, oatmeal, cornmeal, and miss a meal.
That's pretty good.
But let me give you something about my father. This you'll like. We used to say, Dad, we love you, and Mom, we owe you so much. And Dad looked at us and said, you owe us nothing. We owe you everything. Said, you're uninvited guests into this world. You didn't ask to be born. We asked for you. If you do something good, we can hold our heads up proudly and say, those are our boys. But if you do something ugly, we have to bow our head and ask forgiveness because we didn't teach you right. Now, what kind of parent says that today? Isn't that amazing?
A humble one with a lot of perspective.
Oh, yeah, Dad, what a great man.
I guess so.
Anyway, I know you're thinking about the war, and I was going to say, when I graduated, I was 17, and man, December, look, think about it. It was in 1941 when it all started. Mm-hmm. And so my two brothers were drafted in the war. And then when I had to go, I was the baby of the family. Mm-hmm. And so, I went in the combat engineer 1st Division in Camp Swift, Texas, 146 combat engineers. It was a brand new battalion. And since it was so new, I got to make sergeant the first 3 months that I was in the Army.
I got to ask you, before we get too far along in that, I bet your memory is so clear and so strong, as everyone can hear. I've got to believe you remember December 7th, 1941, and where you were and how you heard that news.
Oh, yeah, golly, Moses, not possible. December 7th, 1941, it's almost like when I remember Kennedy when he was shot. Mm-hmm. We couldn't believe it. We said, what it is, I'm just thinking, 1941. Graduated from high school, just barely going, and didn't know. Mm-hmm. The news was going on, but there's no such thing as TV, as you know.
Yeah.
But we were all just, we heard rumors of this, that, and the other, and when that happened, it was like, golly, what's going on?
Shocked your system a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And what did your, so you had two older brothers?
Yeah.
What did they end up doing in the service?
Well, my oldest brother, Joe, was a crew chief for bombardiers.
All right.
And he worked on airplanes. The middle brother was in the Air Force. He wanted to go be a pilot. We both wanted to be pilots. But he didn't take the examination because he was afraid I might not be able to pass the examination. That's my middle brother. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't go in the Air Force because he thought, well, if my baby brother can't go, I'm not going to go.
Huh.
I went in the when the combat engineers took the Air Force examination, passed it, and called him, and he took it, and he went straight into there from there for the.
But he didn't do it till you did it.
That's right. He waited for me. Oh, golly.
Well, and I know we're bouncing around here. So you told us you're in the engineers at Camp Swift, and then you find out that you can take this examination to qualify for flight training.
Went to Northfield, Vermont, and qualified for bombardier pilot and navigator. 3 days before pre-flight at Maxwell Field, Alabama, we were down there ready to go, and the Battle of the Bulge took place, and 36,000 of us were taken out immediately and gone back to our respective ground and service forces. Mm-hmm. I had to go back in. This time I was in the 1270th Combat Engineers.
And clearly the reason, and people who know their history can put two and two together, but the Battle of the Bulge, the reason that changed so much is there's so many casualties.
Right.
They need bodies to replace the bodies who
That's
are no
it.
Longer able.
Yes.
So all your ambitions of flying for our country are gone, and you're back in the engineers, and then they tell you you're heading overseas?
Yes. Yes, went straight over there, landed at Weston-super-Mare, England, stayed there for a little training, and went to Le Havre, France, went where we went in.
Mm-hmm.
Joined Patton's Stern Army, combat engineers. Man, do you... No, I can't say it. Yeah, I can. Did you see Patton?
Sure.
You remember when he says, Rommel, you magnificent son of a...
I read your book!
Remember that line?
Yeah.
Man, that was him. Man, he didn't want to stop. He wanted to go right straight into Russia right now.
Yeah, he did. Yep. And there are some interesting theories about that. Did you ever see him? Did you ever come across him?
No. Well, just faintly, because we were moving all over. We were ahead building pontoon bridges and clearing minefields. That's what happened. But when he had those Carolina pistols,
yep.
He wasn't saying, "You all going up there, I'll be there later." He'd say, "Come on, gang." He was up there in the front. Boy, a powerful man.
He had a gift of leadership and motivation, and certainly we know that's one of your gifts as well. But your task at the time as this young guy out of Oklahoma was, as you said, building pontoon bridges and clearing minefields.
We went through things, places, Paul, that the infantry hadn't even gone through because we were ahead of them getting things done. People look out the window, "Who are these guys? What are they doing coming here?" We were going so fast, we were 10 miles from the Czech border when the war ended.
Everybody seems to have a welcome to the war moment, if you will, a spot where you say, "Oh, this is what it's really like." Was there a moment like that for you where you realized that what you were doing was potentially dangerous and hazardous to your health?
I think we were too young. We were just going, whatever they said. Let's go. Come on, guys.
But I mean, when I hear clearing minefield, I mean, that doesn't sound like an adventure to me. That sounds like, uh-oh, if I make a wrong step or poke the wrong spot, I might die.
Well, right, but at that point, we were so carefully taught things to do that we didn't think about that.
What was that process like? What would you guys do if you had an area of land that they say there may still be mines in here and you have to remove them or disable them? How would that work?
I had all kinds of ways of going through it, but mainly our stuff was still building the pontoon bridges and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll never forget when we went through Buchenwald concentration camp and we saw these people laying on these wooden slabs, reaching out under there trying to say, thank you for helping us. We thought, I can't believe this. It's not possible. We walk on through the barracks and we go out in the back and there are cubicles back there in the back. Hundreds of bodies nude laying in these cubicles just like they've been thrown out like you would with cattle or something waiting to be cremated. We thought, this is not possible. That will I'll never forget.
Mm-hmm.
But
had you ever, before you got there to Buchenwald, had you ever heard of this idea of a concentration camp? Did you know that the Jews were being exterminated and tortured and treated the way they were?
Well, we heard it, but it didn't register because it's like a lot of people didn't even know this when they lived very close to it because they kept it away from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You just young. See, again, we're young kids, and we're in the army. We're going. We tried to do have as much fun as we could, even though it was strictly you never know what's going to happen.
And you alluded a moment ago to that air of invincibility, or that bravado of youth that says, "Hey, it might happen to somebody else, but it's not going to happen to me."
Yes. Yeah.
That said, in your time overseas, did you ever have that thought? I might not make it back home to America?
No.
Not once?
No. I can't remember that.
Did you feel that you had some kind of protection that was going to bring you home?
Well, yeah, faith. You got that. That's the only thing. I had so much deep faith that I've never lost.
Mm-hmm.
That means more than it kills me when someone doesn't even have any faith of any kind. At my age, you think, oh, golly. I was married to a little English girl for 40 and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
After the war was over, I stayed in England, went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. Can you imagine me? How now, brown cow, you all? But I went and I met her at the Stage Door Canteen, which was like for over here, and Rainbow Corner is called. And every week I'd put on a show for the soldiers, mm-hmm. all over where I met Muriel. Then we started going. I met her mother and dad, and I said, I'd like for her to come to America. And so we tried to make arrangements for me to come to America, but I didn't have a job or anything. She couldn't come. They wouldn't let her come over with me. So, but I came over by myself. A year and a half later, Dad had to post a $500 bond to get her over here because I didn't have any money anyway. But I promised him, I said, if you let Muriel come to America and she likes my family, we'll get married. If she doesn't, I'll send her home. Nobody's hurt. But if we do get married, we're going to stay married, and I'll see she gets home. Well, they thought, that's fine. Once he leaves, she'll forget about him. But she came over a year and a half later. We were married. September the 26th, 1947, she went home 39 times during the next 40 and a half years we were married. I brought her mother over here twice, her mother and dad once, and they said, you kept your promise.
I guess so. And I want to explore more of that, and I know, again, we're going in and out here, but I want to make sure I capture all of this, too. So you mentioned the concentration camp, and my grandfather was there at Buchenwald, and I heard his stories, and it haunted him for years. I mean, he had nightmares and flashbacks of some of the things he experienced there. What was the biggest impact of that experience on you, of what you saw, what you heard, what you witnessed there?
Well, the engraved in my mind as I was going through the barracks, just really to see these people, to think, I can't believe here. They're just there laying on those wooden slabs. Just enough room to slide in and out. And then I remember seeing one man when we went in the back in one place. He was just sitting there, the little face looking like, I don't know what's happening. He was just alone sitting there. And I thought, golly, I couldn't talk to him or anything. There's no way. But those are the things that are in my mind that I can't. Wouldn't want to forget either, but
sounds like it was appalling to you, but also just shocking to know that people could be treated that way.
That's it. I'll never forget our platoon sergeant when he stood there and started crying, and I thought, golly Moses, powerful guy, but it was through such like I can't. What's happened? Why? What are we seeing? What are we seeing here? We're going through things. We're doing things that are. Not as close to this. And I think, well, that was it. We were fortunate in the sense that I missed a lot of that. When we were doing our work, we were kind of by ourselves. But when you see the things like concentration camps, it's almost a dream.
About a month after the liberation of Buchenwald, Nazi Germany surrenders, VE Day. Was that a big day for you?
Oh, yes. Yes, you talk about dancing in the streets. We couldn't even imagine such a thing. Oh, golly.
It's time for our final break, but there are more memories from the late, great Jimmy Weldon still ahead, including how his voice became part of a legendary show that a whole new generation of Americans is enjoying today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their Wall of Honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that Wall of Honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special tribute episode to Jimmy Weldon, a World War II veteran who spent the entirety of his post-war life entertaining, educating, and inspiring. Jimmy Weldon passed away July 6th, just 2.5 months short of his 100th birthday. Jimmy's request was to be cremated and have his ashes interred in London next to his beloved wife Muriel, who passed away in 1988. A celebration of life is being planned for American Legion Post 43 in Hollywood, where Jimmy was chaplain emeritus. It was in uniform in Europe during World War II with the 1270th Engineer Combat Battalion that Jimmy's ability to engage audiences really started to take off.
Every time they had someone come over that was a celebrity, they would put a program, and I did the MC. I was MC of the program and did something. And when the war was over, Colonel Connors, who was our battalion commander, called me and he said, I'm going to put you, I want you to go into Chafe headquarters, General Eisenhower. He went over and he said, this fellow should have been in the entertainment industry, all entertainment department of the Army all of his career. He said, so we're going to move him into here. Mm-hmm. And I went into Chafe headquarters, and that's where I spent the last few weeks in the Army before I went to the Royal Academy. We were sitting there, and one of the guys said, are you going to stay over here and go to school? I said, no, I'm not going to school. I'm an actor. I'm going to Hollywood. Said, well, why don't you stay here and go to school? I said, I don't want to go to school. And he said, well, why don't you just look at what we have? I said, give me the list. Let me have it. I saw all these great universities thing. I got into the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. I said, that's the one I want to go to. They said, you got the only one and you couldn't get in. I said, give me a pass. I went over to London and met Sir Kenneth Barnes, who was the head of the Royal Academy. And I said, Sir Kenneth, I got to come to this school. I told him a story about when I was a little boy and about to have cried and said, Mama, he killed that guy. I said, I've got to be an actor. He said, by Jove, I'll accept you. And that's why I went to Royal Academy. Can you imagine that?
Backtracking again, when you say that you emceed any time one of these USO shows and a celebrity would come by, who are some of those names?
Mickey Rooney came in, and he and I had the same birthday. He died. He was just 3 years older than I am. But I let him use my gun that Dad sent me overseas because I wanted to have a sidearm. I had a .45, mm-hmm. and Mickey Rooney wore it in the play that he did when he came over. We talked about it later when he came out to Hollywood. I never thought I'd see him again. Mm-hmm. But Red Skelton, I emceed his program at Camp Swift when he did a program. He used to go around. Any of the celebrities that came out, they'd say, get Shin. That's my name. I mean, right. Jimmy
Weldon's a Hollywood name.
That's it.
But
it was because of my oldest brother. Uh-huh. And the middle one, that's how I got their name. I took their names.
So who, your oldest brother?
Yeah,
was...
I was overseas. We were in had just gone into France.
Mm-hmm.
And he got this letter from Mom and Dad, and they said, Bub and Betty had a little boy, and they wanted to name him Jimmy Weldon. And he said, Bub, my oldest brother said, no, we can't use no Fern's names. My oldest brother's name was Joe Weldon Shin, S-H-I-N-N. The middle boy, James Lemoyne Shin. Paul, you're sitting here with Ivy Laverne Shin. I got invitation to every woman's college that was in existence. How they ever did this, I don't know, but my dad's baby brother was named Ivy, and where they got Laverne, I don't know. But Moyne and I went to school without the L.A. We'd call each other Moyne and Vern. Mm-hmm. Everybody did that. So when I read this letter, they said, want to name him Jimmy Weldon. That's Bub's second name and Moyne's first name.
Yeah.
And I said, Jimmy Weldon, I like that name. That's what I'm going to be known as for right now. That was right in France.
You're still in the service. You're still Ivy Laverne Shin.
That's right. And yep. then so now when I go into Chafe headquarters, I told these guys, I said, I've got a new name I want to use. And these fellas said, you're Jimmy Weldon for us. I was almost engaged to Muriel before she knew I wasn't Jimmy Weldon because they said something about, she said, I'm going to America, and said, what relation is she to you? And she said, that's my husband going to be. Because Ivy Laverne, that's got to be women. I told Mom, I said, where in the thunder you all got those names? But anyway, it's amazing. Muriel was on Little House on the Prairie 8 years. Trapper John 5 years as a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
Famous. I mean, great dancer.
Yeah, you were a Hollywood couple, to be sure. But you didn't tell us the story of how you met. You told us you met her and you brought her home as a war bride, but how did you meet Muriel?
All right. I was putting on my show over there at Rainbow Corner.
Uh-huh.
And she was supplying drinks for the soldiers behind the desk. In fact, anyone that was in the entertainment industry over there, part of their work, their actual work was to entertain the soldiers or be at Rainbow Corner serving drinks and dance with them and something.
Mm-hmm.
So she was serving Cokes. She said, would you like to dance with me? And I said, I'm not a good dancer. And she said, well, I'm not either. Either like that. And so we got on the dance floor and I said, man, you can't dance very well, can you? She said, no. Later, I go down to see where she is. She said, would you see the show I'm in? She was one of the principal dancers at the Night in the Music, the longest-running show in London, Vic Oliver's Night in the Music. He was married to Sarah Churchill, Vic Winston's daughter.
Uh-huh.
And when I saw her, I said, good golly, there's Muriel out on that stage as one of the principal dancers. And I said, she can't dance. But anyway, we had a great life. 4.5 years, look, I tell people now. I said, Muriel was married to her 4.5 years, little English girl, then she left me. They said, oh, that's an English girl. I said, oh, wait a minute, I don't know where she is. Oh, really? I said, yeah, now tell them the story. I was in the hospital with her at St. Joseph's Hospital, crying my heart out. And she said, oh, darling, please pray to let Jesus take me now. I said, what's going to happen to me? She said, you have such a wonderful life motivating others about their future. Don't cry. I'll just be there waiting for you. And I watched her pass away right there in front of me. I tell everybody I don't know where she is. Denver Pyle. Do you remember his name? The actor?
Mm-hmm.
I gave Muriel's memorial service. He said, you can't do this. I said, I'm the only one that can. So in our church, when he walked, I walked over, and Denver and his wife, Tippy, were sitting over to the side, and I said, hey, Denver, why are you, Tippy, sitting way over here? And he said, Weldon, if the show's no good, I'm leaving. That was at Muriel's memorial service. We had a good time. But anyway, that's life goes on. You can't stop.
Had you been doing the duck voice all along?
Yeah, but just as a fun thing, when I went in radio back in Chickasha, 250-watt station, first job, I asked the manager, I said, could I do a program with the little duck voice I do? Couldn't call him Donald Duck. I had to name him something. So anyway, in my book, I tell how I changed the name because I'd use little Webster. Like, I'd take the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting here at the mic, and I'd say, oh, there's a little fella over at the door. Hey, who are you?
I'm a duck.
Well, come over here.
All right, I'll be right here.
And he'd come over to the microphone, and people would call in and say, who's this guy? Because they thought it was two different people.
Yeah.
And so that's where we developed Little Webster's voice, and he loved Spike Jones and all that. And that's where it kept on going. And finally, when television came along, they said, you're going to have to get a duck. I said, what do you mean, ventriloquist? I said, I move my mouth more talking like a duck than I do myself. And, well, you got to learn. And so that's when I developed the thing of having a little Webster. And I look at Webster. And most ventriloquists look out in the audience like, how good they can do without moving their mouth. I had to look at him because I moved my mouth more talking to him than I did myself. But people used to tell me, they say, how do you make his eyes move? He didn't move anything. It was just the expression that we did for each other. You know?
Yeah, it made it seem like he did.
Yeah.
I've got to ask you, and maybe I'm way off on this, but you know, it seems that a lot of the great ideas and the true inspiration and the creativity that we take for granted so often, that a lot of times when it's first expressed or first originated, it's not quite as popular. Or there's naysayers and there's people that say, that's a horrible idea. You ought to quit doing that. Did you ever have somebody tell you that was bad?
Did I? The director of my first director, Dawes Butler, everybody said, well, Mr. Campbell was the one. He liked me. He heard me on radio. Mm-hmm. And when I got the duck, he's the one told me, you got to get a duck. Because we bought a television station. I said, okay. So I got this, and then I came back and started, had Webster with me, and we were doing an audition out there at WFAA TV.
In Dallas.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
The director, Ash Dawes, my director, and three other guys, this is the dumbest thing. He won't last a week on the air. Mr. Campbell said, make his show good. And if it hadn't been for Mr. Campbell having faith in me, I would never done anything here. And later on, they said, well, he saw something in you we didn't. Mm-hmm. But then, and I gave my life story to a group of doctors. When he called me one day and he said, Jimmy, he said, this is Dr. Abrams. Would you come down and give your life story to 150 doctors and their wives? I said, what? He told me, see, I was looking at the paper this morning. I saw, and he said, darling, I'm reading this paper article here about a man talking like a duck for a living. There's got to be a reason. I think he'd be interested to be one of our programs. So I go down there. I talk, and I take a little Webster out, and we do a little fun thing. I got through, and he said, well, I'm not interested in you, but I'll buy any part of that duck. And that's where it all started, you know, on TV. So I've been so fortunate, man, really. God gives us talents, but our creative imagination is far greater than any talent we have. Remember what I just said? Our talent is good, but the creative imagination we have is far greater. Thomas Alva Edison working on a incandescent light, and his assistant came in one day and said, Mr. Edison, I'm not really sure what you're working on, but you failed 967 times so far. And he said, no, I've just eliminated 967 ways that won't work.
Mm-hmm.
I said, God gave him that electric light in his mind before it ever appeared on a laboratory table. I said, don't stop. That's the key. So important. And so when you have a dream, just think about it. There'll never be another you. No way, shape, or form. Nobody can ever think like you do.
Mm-hmm.
You're unique in every way. The idea, though, that the key is so important, don't stop. Once you have your dream and you make a goal, don't stop. And that's what happened to me. I'd been on the air with Little Webster for, since 1950. Now I'm in Fresno, right, and I heard a man speak on the word motivation. A desire held in expectation with the belief that it will be realized. Never heard that word before. When he started talking, I said, golly, I was listening to it. He said, there are millions of bodies in our cemeteries whose epitaph should read, died at 20, buried at 90, because they mistook their first goal as success and stopped. So when you reach your goal, you must keep reaching higher and higher. It's not a destination. It's a journey that never ends. Got two things going for us, Paul.
Yeah.
One of which we have no control whatsoever. That's time. One of my pet peeves, someone say, do it this way and save time. You can't save one billionth of a second. Think about the time we've been on the air together now here.
Mm-hmm.
All these minutes are gone. You can't get them back. Can't save time. Spend your time wisely. The only thing we own lock, stock, and barrel is our attitude. Don't let anyone step on your attitude. I will hear not those who weep and complain, for their disease is contagious. Let them join the sheep. The slaughterhouse of failure is not my destiny. The prize of life are at the end of each journey, not near the beginning, and it's not given to me to know how many steps are necessary in order to reach my goal. Failure I may still encounter at the thousandth step, yet success hides behind the next bend in the road. Never will I know how close it lies unless I turn the corner. Always will I take another step. If that is of no avail, I will take another and yet another. In truth, one step at a time is not too difficult. I will try and try and try again. Each obstacle I consider is a mere detour to my goal and a challenge to my profession. I will persist and develop my skills as a mariner develops his by learning to ride out the wrath of each storm. So long as there's breath in me, that long will I persist. For now I know one of the greatest principles of success, if I persist long enough, I will win. I will persist. I will win. That's one of the scrolls in the Ogmandino's greatest salesman ever lived. I memorized that and I've given it in churches many times in years, yeah.
And I know you've got a fountain of motivational pieces like that. And I'm interested in your journey, because I'm sure as that 7-year-old kid, you never could have imagined all the twists and turns from going off to war, surviving that, meeting your wife, bringing her home. You both find careers in show business. But you started out, and you kind of went past this quickly. You start out at a brand new radio station that had never had a single announcer before. You're the very first announcer on this brand new radio station right after World War II in Oklahoma. You create this character, and he takes off, so you're on television in Texas, then in Hollywood, then in Fresno, and Salinas, and Bakersfield, and you're flying back and forth in your own plane to all these stations?
Yes.
I mean, who does that?
Well, I don't know. I've been the most fortunate guy God ever let live.
And you had talked about wanting to be a pilot, and your flight training gets cut short because they need bodies in Europe, and you go over as an engineer. Did you learn to fly right after you got back, or
yes.
How did you become a pilot?
Yeah, Moen, my brother, he was still in the Air Force. I mean,
yep.
Now we're home. We buy a Super Cub together, and that's when I got my license, 1946. But, Paul, here's the key. You said it when you went by here.
Yeah.
Every time I do anything, if it's a commercial or any part in a film, that little boy comes to life again.
You know, one thing that I believe, that if there's anything that I've learned, is that it's God's plans are always better than my plans. No matter how I line things up, his ideas are always better. And it strikes me that with your acting and voicing career, you've got this character, Webster Webfoot. You aren't pitching him to Hollywood and saying, hey, you need to put me on. They heard about you and they came to you and said, let's do this new Hanna-Barbera show. So
yes.
What was the first thing you heard about this idea of Yogi Bear, who's now, everybody knows Yogi Bear.
Can't believe it. Yeah, when Bill Hanna called me and told me who he was, said, we're going to start a new program called Yogi Bear, and he said, there's a little duck here named Yaki Doodle. We just want you to do the voice.
Mm-hmm.
I said, fine. But like I say, I had no idea what it would mean.
How did they find you?
They heard me saw me doing Webster.
They saw you on television.
Right, yeah. Yep. So and that's when they called me to come in. It's unbelievable what that little character has meant. Like I said, wherever I go, they always say, always wondered what the guy looked like, did the voice, that little duck. Paul, wherever I go, it makes no difference. And he's still on the air today. Mm-hmm. In other words, Hanna-Barbera program of Yogi Bear is on Cartoon-a-Rooney and Boomerang. I never dreamed one day that I would be able to touch the lives of young people by doing a voice that I did on television 53 years ago that they register now with me. It means, in other words, that is something tangible. I can see if they got an old guy that's going to come talk to you about the war and what America means. That's nothing. But when they hear that I'm Yaki Doodle and they say, golly, because I always say we're all children when we can get away with it. Only difference between an adult and a child is just the cost of the toy. And I'm always saying this too. Psychic income only appears in an income tax. No, it's in the heart. Recognition for an entertainer is the greatest income there is.
Mm. You know, powerful words.
Yeah, instead of saying, oh, I know that old jerk. But if they say, oh, I remember him. And when someone comes up and says, Uncle Jimmy, when they say Uncle Jimmy, I want to cry. One of the at-risk students one time, a little girl came up. When I say little, she's 15 years old. And she said, Mr. Weldon, I forgot all of my problems when you were talking just now. Thank you for coming to speak to us. And I think, good golly, those kind of things are just knock me out. That's why I say the two greatest things you can ever say to anybody are these, thank you and I love you. Hmm. They're not used enough. I close with prayer at our American Legion in every meeting because I'm the chaplain emeritus. And I always talking about, I say, Father, we thank you so much for those heroes that are represented by that MIA flag draped over that empty chair. They're with you right now and post everlasting. We'll all be together someday, but thank you. They gave their all that we can be free right here tonight as we're standing together in our little building, the American Legion. How blessed we are to live in a country, greatest that was ever designed, and yet if we're not careful, we'll lose it. Our freedoms we take for granted, and yet we don't really realize how blessed we are.
How blessed we are, and how blessed we were to have Jimmy Weldon on the planet for the last 99 years and 10 months. It sure brought back some great memories for me to listen to his voice, or voices, again today, and I trust it did for you as well. You can link to our complete original interview with Jimmy and find videos of this one-of-a-kind entertainer at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. It is hard to listen to his voice, his passion, his creativity, his hopeful outlook, and not feel at least a little bit inspired. Here's hoping Jimmy Weldon's legacy will continue to have that effect for years to come. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.